Chasing the Sun, the new science of sunlight and how it shapes our bodies and our minds. This is fascinating. We will be back with Linda Geddes in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. George Norrie with you. Let me tell you about our special guest. Linda Geddes is a British journalist writing about biology, medicine, technology. Born in Cambridge, she graduated from Liverpool University with a first-class degree in cell biology, spending 9 years at New Science magazine, working as a news editor, features editor, reporter, remains a consultant to that magazine as well. Linda has received numerous awards for her journalism, including the Association of British Science Writers Awards for Best Investigative Journalism, her book tonight, Chasing the Sun. Linda, welcome to the program. Looking forward to this.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How did you get involved in studying the strength of the sun?
Well, So I worked, as you just said, I worked at New Scientist magazine for a long time. And I guess around 15 years ago, I started noticing a lot of stories about these things called circadian rhythms. And circadian rhythms are these kind of 24-hour fluctuations in the activity of pretty much every biological process in our bodies, from, you know, from when we feel tired and alert to when we release various hormones, to the chemistry of our brains and the functioning of our immune cells. All these things actually vary over the course of 24 hours. And there were more and more stories coming out about these things, you know, things like you could alter the timing of when you give chemotherapy drugs for cancer and end up with fewer side effects. And also around that time, the International Agency on Cancer Research had just pronounced shift work a probable carcinogen. So there was this kind of growing sense that light at the wrong time and being active at the wrong time of day, as you do when you work shifts, might be bad for your health. And then I was interested in circadian rhythms, and then I had to go on a work trip to Las Vegas. Randomly with a bunch of forensic scientists.
Sure.
But during that trip, I had really bad jet lag because I'd flown from London to Las Vegas. And then I spent 3 days inside this windowless meeting room in this business hotel. And I felt like I was going crazy. I was just, and then in the evenings, running around the casinos and whatever. And I was, by the end of this, I was just absolutely desperate to just get outside and sit in the sun and have a cup of coffee. And I just couldn't find anywhere to sit because I wasn't in one of these big resorts. I was in a business hotel, and there was no pool or anything like that. And the whole of Las Vegas seems to have been kind of set up to almost hide its residents from the sun and kind of create this almost topsy-turvy world where, you know, the activity takes place at night, and in the daytime everything's really quiet. And I was just kind of going from resort to resort through these underground shopping malls, getting more and more desperate to find somewhere to sit outside. I found myself in Caesar's Palace arcade, you know, surrounded by this beautiful kind of mock Greco-Roman architecture, and then I saw what I thought was sunlight up ahead, and I got really excited, and I was like, here we are at last. And then I got there, and I looked up and just saw this, like, glorious but completely artificial sky. And it just kind of struck me, really, that, you know, our relationship with the natural light-dark cycle, which is controlled by the sun, has been completely perverted in the modern world. And I thought, you know, I'd like to know more about this, because our circadian rhythms are affected by light.
They sure are. I remember we used to, years ago, Linda, breed racehorses, and in order to get the mare ready to go, we had to trick them, and we turned lights on in the barns.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah, and it worked. It worked, because the rhythm was off unless they see something that resembles sunlight or is like that. But we live in a society where they basically have forced us to believe sunlight is no good for us. How do we get around that?
Well, the issue is that, I mean, there's two things to separate out. One is sunlight and one is light. So we live in a society where we don't see any sunlight in the daytime. We stay shut indoors, mm-hmm. and then in the evening we see artificial light. But then you're right. So that affects our circadian rhythms. But then there's also this worry about sunlight in particular causing cancer. And there's no doubt that too much sun exposure causes mutations in the DNA in our cells, and that can lead to mutations that cause the cells to grow abnormally, and that can lead to cancer. So I'm certainly not saying that we should be sunbathing and definitely not going out and getting burnt. But at the same time, there's also mounting evidence that the sun is doing stuff to our skin which may be beneficial. And this is completely aside from the circadian rhythms, which comes down to light and the eye and the brain. So when the sun hits our skin, a few things happen. Most people will be aware that you make vitamin D, which is really, really important for your bone and tooth health. But it seems to do other things as well, actually. So for one thing, vitamin D isn't just about bones and teeth. You know, you find vitamin D receptors all over the body, on the heart, in the brain, in your immune cells. So you know, back in the 1920s, there was this real craze for sun cures, and people believed that the sun could pretty much help with the treatment of any disease. But in particular, at that time, there was this problem of tuberculosis of the skin, of the lungs, of the bones. And what doctors used to do with tuberculosis patients was send them to these sanatoria in the mountains, where they had them sunbathe on these big sunny decks. And it worked. And probably the reason it worked, in fact, we know the reason it worked now, is that you have these immune cells in your lungs which respond to vitamin D by starting to spew out this antimicrobial substance called cathelicidin. And so the vitamin D is helping those immune cells kill the bacterium that's responsible for tuberculosis. And then the sun does other things to our skin as well. So another reason why too much sun exposure increases our risk of skin cancer is that it suppresses the immune system. So I've just said that the sun helps some bits of the immune system, but it suppresses immune cells in our skin.
Well, how much is too much?
Well, nobody knows for sure. But if you have too much sun exposure, your immune cells are less good at detecting cancer cells. But a bit of sun exposure may be important for keeping the immune system in check. So you find that autoimmune diseases like multiple sclerosis are more prevalent the further you travel from the equator. So the further north or south you go, the higher the incidence of multiple sclerosis. And possibly that is because the sun is actually helping to dampen these kind of out-of-control immune responses. And then there's a final thing that the sun seems to do, which is that when we're exposed to sunlight, we trigger the release of this substance called nitric oxide, which is basically, it causes your blood vessels to relax and dilate and become wider. And so your blood pressure drops. So for a while, you know, scientists have realized that actually people's blood pressure is lower in the summer than it is in winter. And, you know, one idea was maybe it's because it's warmer in summer. But it turns out that actually we release this nitric oxide, and that is directly responsible for this drop in blood pressure when you're exposed to the sun. But in answer to your question, we don't know quite how much sun is enough. Certainly for vitamin D, you will make vitamin D without getting sunburn. And we know for sure that sunburn is directly associated with skin cancer, and in particular melanoma, which is the most deadly form of skin cancer.
And some people...
The answer is, I mean, my approach is little and often, so I have fair skin. I'm kind of Scottish originally. I don't sunbathe anymore, but I do get outside a lot. I run, I swim in lakes, I get outside, but I'm just careful about protecting my skin. So I don't, you know, but I don't completely slather myself in factor 50 or factor 100.
Well, I was going to say, some people are more prone to getting the sunburns, like you said, you're fair, more light-skinned than maybe somebody else who would be more apt to be able to take more sunlight, let's say because they're darker-complected?
Absolutely, and you know, certainly in the country I live in England, people with dark skin, so black skin, for instance, or Indian skin, there's an increasing problem with vitamin D deficiency, because those people need to have more sun exposure to make the same amount of vitamin D as I need. So I think the problem is it's very difficult to give, you know, uniform advice for everyone, because we all have different skin tones. But I think, you know, that rule of don't stay outside so much that you get burned is a good one to stick with. And also, you know, I'm sure we'll talk more about this, but in terms of the circadian benefits of being outside, you don't have to be in direct sunlight for that. You can just be, you know, you can be in the shade and just it's still hugely brighter than it is indoors.
You stayed with an Amish family. Tell me about that. Where was that? Was that in the States?
Yeah. So while I was researching the book, I became really interested in this idea of, well, you know, there's lots of media reports about the harmful effects of blue light at night and electric light at night. So I became really interested in the idea of, well, I wonder what it would be like if I went and stayed with a community who don't have access to electric light anymore. You know, how would that affect their sleep, their mood, these kinds of things? And there have been some studies that have been done on tribes living in Africa or South America, but they live a lot closer to the equator than you or I do.
Sure.
And so there, you know, the difference in the length of the day and night between summer and winter is far less. You know, in England, you know, we're coming up to winter now, and the days are getting shorter and shorter, and that doesn't happen so much in these tribal societies because of where they live. So I started looking for communities that didn't have access to electricity further north, and I came across these a couple of research papers by an American professor called Theodore Postolake at the University of Maryland, and he has been working with Old Order Amish communities in Lancaster County in Pennsylvania, looking at the differences in the amount of light they're exposed to at night and in the daytime, and also the timing of their sleep and their propensity to get seasonal affective disorder. And what he's found is that they are exposed to far lower, I mean, they do have light at night, they have a gas light, but it tends to be in the house with the family I stayed with. They live in a large house. They had a big family, and they have this one single gas lamp on a stand, and it's on wheels. And they'll use it, you know, they'll wheel it into their kitchen when they're preparing dinner and eating dinner, and then, you know, after dinner they'll go and sit and read together, and they'll basically wheel this light into their sitting area, and then just use this one light in order to do their reading. And, you know, if they need to go to the bathroom or whatever, then they'll take a battery-powered torch or something.
Really?
And so their light exposure at night is far lower than most American families. And then in the daytime, because the Amish aren't allowed to drive, and because they tend to keep their community very, very close.
Now, where were you, like in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, out that way?
Yes, I can't remember the name of the town, but it was in rural Pennsylvania,
yeah,
in Lancaster County.
Lots of Amish families out there.
Yeah. So they tend to walk or scoot to work. A lot of people still work in kind of agricultural jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they don't, they tend to be outdoors more in the daytime. The women have a very traditional role. They tend to be at home, but they also tend these large vegetable gardens. So they're also outdoors a lot more during the daytime. So, you know, their days are much brighter, their evenings are much dimmer, and you find that they go to bed a lot earlier than the kind of average American. So the family I stayed with, I trailed them around on Memorial Day weekend, and they said, well, what do you want to do while you're here? And I said, well, I just want to basically stalk you. I basically want to just, you know, I want to just follow you and see how you live.
And take notes and everything else.
And that kind of thing. So they said, well, that's fine. But, you know, tomorrow we would like to go yard sale shopping, and we're going to get up at the same time we always do, which is 4:30.
In the morning.
Out of the house at 5. And I was like, okay, well, I have jet lag, so that's fine. But, you know, we did. We left the house at 5 a.m. We drove to a yard sale because I was with the Amish are allowed to take lifts from people. They're just not allowed to drive themselves. So actually, Professor Postolake's daughter, Sonia, drove me down there in her dad's big truck. And the Amish family I was staying with were very happy about this because it meant that they had, you know, transportation, so they could go to the yard sales and buy stuff and actually transport it home.
Did they have horse and buggies too?
They did, yeah. They took me out in their buggy.
Yep. They have a lot of those.
Yeah. But there's less space for transporting stuff on those buggies. They're quite small. And I interviewed a lot of Amish people, and they all were saying, you know, it's normal to go to bed at around 8:30 or 9 p.m., and we all get up at around 4:30 or 5. There were some people who would say, oh, you know, it's a bit early for me, really. I, you know, I'm a night owl, and I'd say, oh, that's interesting. So when would you like to go to bed, ideally, Mr. or Mrs. Night Owl? And they would say, oh, yeah, like 10 p.m., and I'd be like, okay, that sounds quite early for me, but and when would you like to get up? And they'd be like, yeah, 6 a.m. would be great, or 7 a.m.
Yeah, they
and,
get up early.
That's not that early, so, that's not that late, I mean.
Well, most of the Amish Midland wear hats, so yeah. I would guess they really avoid the sun that way, don't they?
Yeah, well, I guess they're not getting that much direct sun beating down onto their heads, and they all dress relatively conservatively as well. So again, they're not exposing huge amounts of their skin to the sun, but they are outdoors a lot.
Exactly. So was what you were doing, was it an experiment?
I guess it was more anthropology. I was more just trying to understand how this pattern of living affects people's sleep. And, you know, get some colour so that when I wrote Chasing the Sun, I'd be able to describe this experience in a kind of interesting way. But the other interesting thing about the Amish is, and Teodor Postolaki has been doing the rigorous scientific experiments with the Amish. But the other interesting thing about them is that they have the lowest prevalence of seasonal affective disorder in any Caucasian population that's
really
been studied so far. Yeah. So the thinking is that possibly this way of living, where you're exposed to a lot more bright light in the day and dim light at night, and the effect of that is to push your circadian rhythms earlier, so you do become more of a lark, that seems to somehow immunize them against depression and seasonal depression. And we know, for instance, that in seasonal affective disorder, that exposure to bright light first thing in the morning is a cure for seasonal depression. So, you know, by getting up at 4:30, getting up with the dawn, getting out of the house, walking to work, they don't need a sad lamp. They're getting the sun first thing in the morning.
So tell us a little bit about some of the work that you were doing with the Amish in terms of how much sunlight did they actually get during the daytime.
I can't remember the exact figures, but I think it was, you know, if you compare it to, well, okay, let's just backtrack a bit. So we measure illuminance or brightness in this unit called lux, and the typical illuminance in an office is kind of 200 to 300 lux, and the typical illuminance even on an overcast cloudy day is about 5,000 lux, so, you know, 25 times brighter. On a clear, cloudless day in summer, it can be 100,000 lux outside. So it's hugely brighter outside than it is inside. And we don't tend to realize this often because, you know, it's kind of bright enough to see indoors, and because our eyes adapt to gloomy conditions. That's why, you know, when you turn the lights out at night, at first your bedroom will see completely dark, but then gradually your eyes adapt and you can start to make stuff out. So our eyes adapt. But that light is really important for synchronizing these circadian rhythms that we have all over our bodies. But it also affects our alertness. So being exposed to bright light it's been shown in a scientific study to be equivalent to having several shots of caffeine, several cups of coffee.
That's interesting. And
it has this direct alerting effect.
Linda, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back and talk more about your work, Chasing the Sun. And I also want to get into more of this circadian rhythm to see how important that is. Back in a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you with our special guest, Linda Geddes, and her latest book is called Chasing the Sun. Linda, let's talk a little bit about the circadian rhythm. Exactly what is it, and why is it so important?
Sure. Well, circadian rhythm isn't just one thing. I mean, you have these circadian rhythms, like I said, all over your body. And they control the timing of pretty much every biological process. So you know, your alertness, your kind of logical reasoning, your the chemistry of your brain, so your mood. All these things are controlled by these biological rhythms. And the way these things are generated is that actually in every cell of our bodies, we have this kind of molecular clock ticking away. And in some individuals, that clock is kind of closer to 23 hours, and in others, it's closer to 25 hours. And yet, all of us seem to manage to stay synchronized to the 24-hour light-dark circle that we have on our planet Earth. So how does this happen? Well, the way it happens is actually light. So when light, bright light, hits this subset of cells at the back of our eyes, it basically sends a signal to a very small patch of brain tissue called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, or the body's master clock. And that light acts like a kind of stopwatch. It kind of resets the clock. So in some kind of pulls it forward, and others it kind of pulls it back a little bit, and keeps us all synchronized to the 24-hour day on Earth. You can see what happens. So if people are taken away from that kind of light dark cycle, and they've done this, you know, shut people in underground bunkers or sleep labs and kind of messed around with the light dark cycle, what you find is that actually people revert to their innate rhythm. So, you know, like in someone it might be 23 and a half hours. And then you see this in people who are completely blind. So they develop this condition called non-24-hour sleep-wake disorder, where, again, they kind of follow their own internal rhythm, which means they kind of drift further and further away from the time in the real world. And that causes, it basically gives them permanent jet lag. So you know, say you had a 25-hour clock, you know, like you'd wake up on Monday at 8 a.m. and the next day, because you've got a 25-hour clock, you'd be waking up at 9 a.m. and then it keeps going forward. So, you know, pretty quickly you would end up, you know, feeling wide awake in the middle of the night and really sleepy early in the morning. So that light is important for keeping our clocks synchronized to external time. But when we see light, we'll also shift the timing of those clocks. And this is why we can adapt if we go on holiday to somewhere on a different time zone. If we see light at night, it makes us a bit later, so it makes us more owlish. And if we see light early in the morning, it brings us earlier, it makes us more larkish. So the timing of light is important to these rhythms. But then light also does other things. So if we're exposed to light at night, it suppresses the release of this hormone called melatonin. And melatonin is released under the control of the circadian clock, but it basically creates the biological night. So it's released by this master clock in the brain, and it kind of tells all these other clocks around the body and all these other cells, you know, night's coming, it's time to, you know, switch gear. So it will tell the areas of the brain that regulate sleep, you know, night's coming, time to get ready for sleeping. And so this is why if you take melatonin, you know, it can make you feel a bit sleepy. It's not actually a sleep hormone, but it is telling those bits of the brain that control sleep, you know, it's time to get ready for sleeping.
Yeah, melatonin supplements, they're a big deal these days.
Yeah, although we can't get them in the UK, so you have them over there, but we don't get them.
Really? Ours are over the counter. You don't even need a prescription. You just buy them at the pharmacy.
Yeah, and they can actually, if you take them at the right time, they can be really helpful for jet lag, because, you know, they reinforce that signal from the circadian clock that it's night. So when I come over to the States with work, I buy some and take them back to the UK with me.
Do they work for you?
But you have to know how to take them. So you need to, you know, time them with you know, when you want to be going to bed.
Well, and I've also noticed, Linda, that for me, when I've taken it, as you know, to see if you can sleep and stuff, is bizarre dreams. Do you find that the case?
I haven't noticed that, but that's interesting, and I don't know why that would be.
Yeah, either do I. So, you know, with my nature, because, you know, I do a late night radio show, I'm up late, you know, the nighttime, I like the nighttime.
Yeah.
Is there anything wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with that if you're able to sleep in the next day. Because of this ability of the circadian system to adapt, because of, you know, if you see light at night, it will make you more of a night owl. And if you can sleep in the next morning and keep things dark, then that's fine. And actually, you see this with, oil rig workers who go away and are kind of stationed offshore, and they work the night shift, and then they finish their night shift, and then they go to bed and they pull down their blinds. And they can, they can become nocturnal, and that's fine. The problem with a lot of people is that they are seeing light late at night. That's pushing their clock later. It's making them more night owlish. It's keeping them alert later, because light also has this direct stimulating effect on the brain. And so they kind of don't notice their natural sleep signals, and they think, oh, I'm just a night owl. But then they have this problem that the next morning they have to get up for work or school at, 7 a.m., 6 a.m., and it means that they're cutting short their sleep. So I think it's not a problem becoming more night owlish if you don't have to get up for work the next day, because not getting enough sleep is problematic. But, I think the thing is that a lot of people who think they are night owls would not actually be as owlish if they changed their light exposure. So one thing I did while I was researching Chasing the Sun is I teamed up with some sleep researchers at the University of Surrey here in England, and kind of inspired by the Amish and also by a couple of studies that were done in Colorado, which involved sending normal people camping for a few nights to see how that affected the timing of their sleep, because again, they're exposed. If you go camping, you're exposed to lots of bright light in the daytime, and there's not much light available at night. And in those camping studies, they found that people started, even though they said they were night owls, they started wanting to go to bed earlier and waking up earlier. So I was like, well, I've seen what the Amish do. I've seen these camping studies. I wonder what would happen if I was to go cold turkey on artificial light at night and try and get more exposure to bright daylight during the daytime while living in a normal house in Bristol, mm-hmm. and raising a family and having to work at a computer and all that kind of thing. So I teamed up with these sleep researchers to do a little study on myself, and that kind of involved fitting me with a light monitor and sleep tracker. And I filled out lots of questionnaires just before going to bed each night and when I first woke up in the morning to measure things like my alertness and my mood. And what we saw, just like those camping studies and like that kind of anthropological studies in the Amish, is that when I cut out artificial light at night, or when I didn't worry so much about my light exposure at night, but I just tried to get out more during the daytime. And that wasn't like being outdoors all day long, because I'm a journalist, I work at a computer. But it's things like, lingering in the park after taking my kids to school in the morning, going for a walk around the block at 11 a.m., maybe having lunch outdoors, switching kind of indoor exercises, like going, running on a treadmill in a gym for running outside under the sunlight. And in both those conditions, what we found was that my circadian rhythms, and we measured this by looking at the release of this hormone, melatonin, when I started releasing that, we found that my circadian rhythms shifted between 1.5 to 2 hours earlier. And that meant that...
That's pretty dramatic, isn't it?
Yeah, and I was surprised. I mean, I thought maybe I'd see that with the cutting out light at night because of those camping studies. But I was really surprised to see that, even when I didn't worry too much about my evening light exposure, but I spent a bit more time outdoors, that I saw the same thing. And then when I combined the two things, that's when it was 2 hours earlier. So I was surprised by that. But the other thing that surprised me was the way I felt. So, I've sort of said that these circadian rhythms control your mood and alertness.
Your mood and your energy.
Yeah. And what you see is that in the middle of the night, kind of 3, 4 a.m., you have this, real trough in both your alertness and your mood. It's when you're meant to be asleep, really. Then you kind of wake up in the, by the time you normally wake up in the morning, those things are kind of climbing up and getting higher, and your mood is improving and your alertness is improving. But if you then shift your circadian rhythms back by, 2 hours, and become more of a lark, by the time you wake up, at 7 a.m. or whenever you wake up, you're already going to be that little bit higher up that slope of kind of higher mood and higher alertness. And sure enough, what I found was, normally my kids come bouncing into my bedroom at 7:30 in the morning and wake me up.
Yeah, they're ready to go.
And they're ready to go, but I'm not.
Yeah,
I'm
you're not.
Like, what's going on? Okay, I've got to get up. But what I found was when I, especially on those days after I'd been exposed to lots of bright lights in the daytime, I was waking up before my kids came in, and I was raring to go. I was, awake, alert, feeling great. So my mood was better in the mornings, and I was more alert in the mornings, and I didn't have that kind of normal sleep inertia. And actually, I mean, this study, it was interesting from my perspective, but it was just one person. But it has been seen in other larger studies. So there was an American study of office workers in General Service Administration buildings. And in this study, they were interested in, they basically just fitted light monitors to these office workers and just looked at how much light they're exposed to in the daytime, how that affected their kind of sleep, and their mood and that kind of thing. And the reason they were doing this was that the GSA was interested in whether, trying to get more daylight into the buildings was actually helping people, because it's expensive to fit extra windows and whatever to buildings. And actually, kind of disappointingly for them, what they found was that even in these buildings with lots of windows, that once you kind of got in a couple of meters away from those windows, it got dark pretty quickly because of things like, people pulling the shades on the windows, or because of the partitions between the different desks, the light wasn't really penetrating. But then if they divided this population of office workers into people who seemed to be getting more light exposure compared to the ones who were getting less light exposure, they saw this really interesting thing. And that's that the people who were getting more bright light in the daytime, and particularly in the morning, like before noon, they were finding that those people were they were falling asleep faster at night, and they were getting more sleep. So I think the difference between, if you compared the people who were being exposed to the most bright light in the mornings compared to the people who were being exposed to the dimmer light in the mornings, it was taking, on average, I think it was 18 minutes to fall asleep at night compared to 45 minutes. And I think they were getting 20 minutes extra sleep per night, just because they were being exposed to more bright light in the daytime. But their mood was also higher. So if you kind of gave them a sort of standard depression questionnaire, the people who were getting more bright light exposure in the morning had higher mood scores. So they were more happy than the ones who were exposed to less light in the daytime. And then there have been other studies that have shown actually that if you're exposed to lots of daylight, that you sleep better the following night. So you have more deep sleep, which is the kind of restorative sleep. And you also have less fragmented sleep, so you wake up less. And even if you do have fragmented sleep, it doesn't seem to affect you so much the next day. So all of that kind of speaks to this idea that actually, we talk a lot about the harmful effects of light at night, but I think we forget that actually daylight is really, really important to us as well. And actually, that another study recently found that if you, and this was a German study, that if you expose people to bright light during the morning, their alertness continues to be higher, like they have faster reaction speeds throughout the day, even though that light's been removed. And then at night, usually, if you see light at night, it will push your clock later. But in these people who'd seen lots of bright light in the daytime, it was almost like that light exposure had immunized them against the effects of light at night. So that light at night had less impact on their circadian clocks.
How do teenagers cope? They seem to have different patterns than adults.
They do. So when you hit adolescence, you get this natural shift towards later timing. Your circadian rhythms they shift later. It can be about 2 hours later. So asking a teenager to get up for for school at 6 a.m. is like asking you or I to get up at 4 a.m. You know, they are naturally later. But again, that light at night and the lack of daylight is probably amplifying the effect. So it's making them even later than they already are. So I think particularly for teenagers who have to get up early for school, trying to dim the lights in the evening and particularly tune out blue light. So that circadian system is sensitive to the light in all different wavelengths of the spectrum, but it's particularly sensitive to blue spectrum light, which you get from things like LED computer screens and the kind of LED light, ceiling lights, the ones that they don't really look blue. They look really kind of bright white. Compared to the, you know, the kind of more traditional incandescent light bulbs, which are more kind of orangey. I mean, the way people really need to be going is away from that kind of brilliant white light and towards kind of warmer orangey-yellow kinds of light, because that's going to have less effect.
Hospitals are beginning to take this seriously too, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. So what you see, so as well as pushing your body clock later, the kind of light, or earlier, the light exposure also affects the amplitude of these circadian rhythms. So how high and low those peaks and troughs in these biological activities are. And what you see in hospital patients often is a kind of flattening and desynchronization of these circadian rhythms.
Interesting. Linda, we're going to take a break, but we'll come back for more and also taking the phone calls, Chasing the Sun.